VOA 1, The Hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower. And our stories are written especially for people learning English. Today is October 31st, and to many people in the United States, that means one thing, Halloween. Later in the program, we will celebrate with a light-hearted Words in Their Stories about ghosts. But first, the education report. Greg Stockel and Katie Weaver bring us a story about opponents of critical race theory. I will return with this week's Words and Their Stories. Then Jonathan Evans will take us to Turkey. He tells us about a lake there that is affected by climate change. Katie will bring us another story, this time from Mexico, and ancient structures that were recently found there. We will finish our 30 minutes together with John Russell. He will tell us about workers in the United States who are demanding certain things on the job. Keep listening to find out more about those demands. But first, here is Greg and Katie with the Education Report.
The Guilford school system in the northeastern American state of Connecticut is seeing organized opposition from local and national groups. The opposition comes after efforts to look at issues of race and fairness in schools and teaching materials. School leaders started the efforts after the killing of George Floyd last year. His death led to worldwide protests over the treatment of blacks in the United States. But concerns over racial issues had been raised earlier in Guilford after a student wore black facial paint at a football game. There also was a dispute over the use of an image of Indians to represent the school system. The concern was that these issues are considered offensive to blacks and Native Americans.
For years, schools across the U.S. have been teaching diversity and cultural issues without much criticism. But the debate over face covering requirements, shared bathroom use by children of both sexes, and teachings on race have increased interest in school board elections. Jeffrey Hennig is a political science and education professor at Columbia University. He said the recent anger over these issues has been increased by national groups with bigger plans. Some members of the Republican Party, he said, see these issues as ones that can help them win suburban voters in upcoming elections. Hennig explained that this is why the school board elections were getting the energy and attention that they have been getting.
Guilford is a largely white town of 22,000 on the coast of Connecticut. It is a suburb of the more diverse city of New Haven, home to Yale University. Paul Freeman is head of the school system in Guilford. Freeman said students and recent graduates of the school system urged the schools to do more on issues of race and fairness after last year's protests. The work has included a review of study materials to include books from writers with diverse experiences and backgrounds. He said, for example, students also learn about enslaved people who lived in Guilford during the colonial period. Opponents criticized Freeman for asking school administrators to read books including White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. A national group called No Left Turn in Education organized a June meeting in Guilford on what they see as the threat of critical race theory. This summer, conservative activists won the Republican Party's support for the school board. They called for Freeman's removal and hoped to gain control of the school board in the November elections. Their goal is to fight critical race theory, which has become the top issue for conservative activists in school board races across the U.S.
Critical race theory, CRT, argues that the country's institutions work to keep white people as the most powerful group. The term has been used to identify many different ideas. The theory has been discussed mainly at the college level. Many say it is not a part of instruction for students from young children to high school. Danielle Scarpellino is a local business owner. She is one of five candidates who opposed critical race theory. She said in a recent appearance on Fox Television that Guilford school leaders were introducing politics into schools. She said students were being used as political pawns. Tim Chamberlain is another candidate. He said on his campaign website that his child's teachers have tried to persuade him to abandon his conservative viewpoint while discussing issues like climate change and affirmative action. Freeman said the accusation that his teachers are teaching political beliefs could not be more wrong. Christy Faulkner is a molecular biologist. She said she is running for the school board after seeing words like equity and inclusion turned into bad words by her opponents. She said she also worries that if her opponents win, they would not find any middle ground with the current school board members. The head of Guilford's 9-member school board is Kathleen Balestracci, who is not up for re-election. She is a researcher at Yale School of Medicine and a member of the Democratic Party. She said that students and community members asked the schools to create policies on equity and inclusion. She said she has often heard from parents seeking information on policies during her 10 years on the board. But she said she has never seen such anger. Balestracci said when she tried to explain the policies now, some said, "You're lying." I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Gregory Stockel.
Thanks for that story, Greg and Katie. And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. In the United States, October 31st is Halloween, the night when magical, frightening creatures and ghosts, the spirits of those no longer with us, walk the land. Okay, not really, but it is fun to make believe. To mark the day when children dress up frightfully, to collect candy from their neighbors. Our program today will be haunted by ghost expressions. For example, did you know that the word ghost is also used as a verb? But it does not mean to haunt a place. When you ghost an event, like a party, you leave without saying goodbye to anyone, even the host. You just disappear into thin air, like a ghost. But unlike a ghost, you do reappear later, at work, for example, or your exercise class. Some people even ghost a relationship. They simply leave the person without any explanation. That could haunt someone for a long time. It could leave them wondering, what happened? What did I do? But, dear listeners, I would never ghost on you. We are in this English learning effort together. There is not a ghost of a chance that I will leave. I will keep with it to the end. Did you catch our next ghost expression? If something doesn't have a ghost of a chance, it is extremely unlikely that it is going to happen. Now, our next ghost expression has to do with towns, empty towns. If everyone leaves, a town becomes a ghost town. It is a place that no longer has any people living in it, or at least very few. It is abandoned. The businesses have all closed, and the people no longer have a way to make a living. So, they leave. To me, an abandoned ghost town is a much sadder, emptier place than a town full of ghosts would be. Ghost-hunting tourists would probably enjoy visiting a town populated only by ghosts, especially on Halloween. But even a ghost town can be a good place for some workers. For example, writers. A writer just needs a computer. This would be especially good for ghost writers. A ghost writer writes books or stories for someone else, using that person's name, not their own. Let's say one of the ghost hunters wants to write a book about her ghost hunting adventures, but she is not a very good writer. She could pay a ghost writer to help her write her ghost stories. Now, let's imagine that their writing partnership did not go well. Maybe the ghost writer did not get paid, and the ghost hunter just ghosted. Then, years later, they run into each other again, at a ghost convention. For the ghost writer, seeing the ghost hunter is not a pleasant experience. It is like seeing a ghost from the past. A ghost from the past is something unwanted or haunting from your past that comes back to you. Here is another example. If that man or woman who ghosted you years ago comes back into your life, they would definitely be a ghost from the past. Someone you don't want to see again. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. Happy Halloween. Now let's hear from Jonathan Evans.
Lake Tuz, Turkey's second largest lake and home to several kinds of birds, has entirely dried up this year. Water has also gone down at several other lakes across Turkey. Experts say the lakes are victims of drought brought on by climate change and harmful agricultural policies. They warn that the entire area around the Mediterranean Sea is especially at risk. Levant Kurnas is a scientist at Boğaziçi University's Center for Climate Change and Policy Studies. He told the Associated Press, "We have rising temperatures and decreasing rain, and on the other side, the water needs for irrigation in agriculture. It's a bad situation all over Turkey at the moment." For hundreds of years, Lake Tuz had been home to huge groups of flamingos that travel and reproduce there when the weather is warm. But this summer, thousands of dead flamingos were found spread out across the dried-up lake bed. There were about 5,000 young flamingos. They all perished because there was no water, said Fari Tunç. He is the wildlife photographer who took pictures of the dead birds. He also heads the local office of a Turkish environmental group. Tunç said, "I hope I do not come across such a scene again." Turkey's state-run Anadolu agency reported that a study conducted by Ege University shows that water levels at Lake Tuz began to drop in 2000. The study noted that the lake dried up this year because of rising temperatures, increased evaporation, and a lack of rain. The study also noted a sharp decrease in underground water levels around Lake Tuz. Environmental groups say poor government agricultural policies play a major part in the lack of water in Turkey's lakes. Farms in the area have started growing profitable but water-intensive crops such as corn, sugar beets, and alfalfa. These crops have used up groundwater supplies, Tunç said. He added that farmers have dug thousands of unapproved wells, while streams supplying water to the lake have dried up. Tunç is a native of Aksaray, a city to the south of Lake Tuz. He is saddened by the thought that he will not be able to enjoy the flamingos with his 7-month-old son, as he did with his 21-year-old son. He remains hopeful, however, that Lake Tuz may replenish itself if the government stops the water-intensive agriculture. But climate scientist Kurnas is less hopeful. He said, "They keep telling people that they shouldn't use groundwater for this agriculture, and people are not listening." Kurnas noted, "If you don't pay them enough money, the farmers, they will plant whatever is water intensive and will make money for them." I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. Here is another story from Katie Weaver.
A careful study of a large area in Mexico has found hundreds of ancient ceremonial centers. The new findings include a large center at an important place for the ancient Olmec culture that is known for its large stone statues of heads. The study involved a technology called LIDAR. It found 478 ceremonial centers in areas that were home to the ancient Olmec and Maya cultures, dating from 3,400 years to 1,400 years ago. The study was the largest of its kind involving ancient Mesoamerica, covering all of the state of Tabasco, southern Veracruz, and parts of Chiapas, Campeche, and Oaxaca. LIDAR is short for light detection and ranging. It uses a laser and data gathered while flying over a place to create three-dimensional information about the surface. The technology is able to see through thick plants and trees that cover structures below. Takeshi Inomata of the University of Arizona led the study. It was published in Nature Human Behavior. He said LIDAR found a large and previously unknown ceremonial space in Veracruz at the early Olmec site called San Lorenzo. The Olmecs represent the oldest known major Mesoamerican culture. Scientists say the people are believed to have had an effect on later cultures, including the Maya. The ceremonial center in San Lorenzo measures about 1,000 meters by 275 meters. The areas around it may have had houses, Inomata said. The Olmecs carved heads from individual boulders, or very large rocks. The heads are among the most famous art from ancient Mesoamerica. The faces are carved in such a way that experts believe they represent ancient Olmec rulers. 10 of the heads have been discovered at San Lorenzo. Inomata said there may be more of them that remain undiscovered. Many of the hundreds of ceremonial structures identified in the study share common designs with that at San Lorenzo. Many appear to have been built in a way that goes with the direction of the sunrise on important ceremonial dates. These centers were probably the earliest material expressions of basic concepts of Mesoamerican calendars, Inomata said, noting that such calendars were based on 20-day periods. An even larger ceremonial center, described by Inomata and his co-researchers last year, was found in the Maya area called Aguada Phoenix, in Tabasco, near the Guatemalan border. It is not as old as the one at San Lorenzo. That find and others suggest that Olmecs and other peoples in the area exchanged ideas. LIDAR has been increasingly useful for archaeologists. Juan Carlos Fernandez Diaz is a LIDAR engineer and co-writer of the study. The technology's main strength, he said, is that it provides a three-dimensional, bird's-eye view of the landscape and modifications to it made by humans, ancient and modern, in the form of building, transportation, agricultural, and water control infrastructure. LIDAR permits us to see the landscape and infrastructure hidden under forest cover around the world, he said. I'm Katie Weaver.
Thanks again, Katie. Our last story comes from John Russell.
As many American businesses struggle to fill jobs, some have started negotiating demands that used to be non-negotiable for most hourly employees. One of the top demands for many workers is scheduling, the days and times they spend on the job. Hourly workers are now seeking more flexibility in their schedules. That means employees are pushing back against requirements to work weekends, late nights, or holidays. There are currently many job openings in the United States, so workers can be more careful about the jobs they choose. There were 10.4 million job openings at the end of August, and 11.1 million openings the month before. Those numbers are the highest since at least December 2000, when the government started recording the data. At the same time, the U.S. Labor Department said the number of people quitting their jobs jumped to 4.3 million in August from 4 million in July. A recent study from employment company Manpower Group found that nearly 40% of job seekers worldwide said schedule flexibility was one of their top three issues in career decisions. Snagajob.com, an online marketplace for hourly workers, says the word flexibility now appears in about 11% of the more than 7 million job postings on its site. That number was around 8% earlier in the year. InstaWork is an employment marketplace that connects local businesses with hourly workers. It says the rate at which employers were able to fill weekend schedules dropped from January through August compared with weekday work. Such changes are happening as companies try to hire more workers for the upcoming holiday season. Target Corporation, for example, said this month it will pay $2 an hour more to employees who agree to work schedules during busy days of the holiday season. Sumir Meghani is co-founder and CEO of InstaWork. He told the Associated Press that he thinks companies are learning that money alone cannot solve their hiring issues. "It's about flexibility," Meghani said. He added, "It's about workers saying, 'I don't want to work weekends,' or 'I can't work Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays because I don't have childcare or schools haven't reopened, or I am worried about COVID.'" Meghani says hourly workers are now asking how they can get the same work-life balance as workers in other kinds of jobs who can work remotely. During the pandemic, hourly workers were hit especially hard when businesses like department stores and restaurants were forced to close for a few months during the spring of 2020. Those who remained employed at essential businesses like grocery stores found themselves working too much and too hard. Donald Minerva is the owner of a restaurant called Scotadito Osteria Toscana in Brooklyn, New York. He told the AP that right before the pandemic, he had 16 employees who worked different schedules at his restaurant, which was open 6 days a week. Now, Minerva has 14 workers, and he keeps his restaurant open just 5 days a week with limited hours. Minerva says 70% of his workers are from the pre-pandemic days and want to work 40 hours a week. But the new workers want more flexibility. "It's a juggle to find them and a juggle to keep them," he said. I'm John Russell.
Thanks, John. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. Some content in this program was provided by the Associated Press or Reuters News Agency. And don't forget to join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo. Happy Halloween!